Support for the BTPM NPR What's Next podcast comes from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, partnering with the community to pursue racial and socioeconomic health equity. Learn more at hfwcny.org.
From Buffalo, Toronto Public Media, this is What's Next, an hour dedicated to amplifying the voices of marginalized and underrepresented communities across Western New York and Southern Ontario.
We cannot erase, we cannot reform, we cannot make things better if we're uncomfortable having tough conversations,
absolutely,
if we're uncomfortable
absolutely
talking about race.
What's Next carries forward our mission to engage in meaningful conversations about race, equity, and the shared concerns that deeply affect Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
Don't stop. Make those families part of your life. Their lives are part of yours. Don't stop.
Together, we dive into the real issues, striving for understanding, connection, and change.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
Good morning and welcome to another episode of What's Next. I'm executive producer Charles Gilbert. Today, we continue our preview of the Sankofa Conference with Naila Ansari-Cotillo speaking with Talia Johnson-Huff of MWBE Constructors. But first, we hear from contributor Saladin Allah, who sits down with the new executive director of Neighborhood Legal Services, Bill O'Connell. This conversation has been edited for length. The full interview will air at a later date.
To tell you a little bit about myself, my background is in education. And one thing that I will always do at the beginning of the school year is I would ask my sixth grade students, what would they like to be? And I noticed over time that their interests changed. You know, you always get people that want to go to the NFL or go to the NBA. You get a few lawyers, doctors, veterinarians, but then it started to change and people wanted to be influencers, YouTubers. What did you want to be when you were a lot younger?
Oh, wow. I didn't know you were going to ask that question.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think like a lot of kids, when you are maybe a little argumentative or you ask a lot of questions, you know, if people say, you should be a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so that was always kind of in the back of my mind. Of course, I wanted to play in the NFL and and do that as well. But without those physical gifts, you know, I decided to lean into kind of the social justice field. And, you know, in terms of how I got into that, when I was in college, I went to a Jesuit university. Okay. And the Jesuits, it's a Catholic order, but they're very into social justice. Okay. And there was a group of students there who were, you know, consistently involved in working in the community, whether it be a soup kitchen or a food pantry or, you know, helping folks access services. And so that led me to join an after college, did a year of service with a group called the Jesuit Volunteer Corps. Mm-hmm. And through that, I worked in New York City as a community organizer.
Wow.
Lived in community. Our home was actually in the convent attached to a church.
Okay.
But we worked out in the community. And my job was as a community organizer was to help folks, you know, get the drug dealer off the stoop or figure out how to help folks access public benefits. But that's that that really kind of, I don't know, it's kind of, they had a saying that we used to say that that when you did this kind of work, you were ruined for life. Meaning that you would never look at things the same way because you started to identify injustice and you started to see systems at work and see where they work and where they don't work.
Yeah.
And when you really start to peel back that onion, there's no going back. Mm. And you can't do any, when you have been that deep and seen that much, you can't do anything but do this kind of work.
Like what would you say was one of your most eye-opening experiences in that time that really shifted your consciousness?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think, you know, one of the things was, you know, I would spend some time, it was at this soup kitchen called Diamonds in the Rough in Brownsville, Brooklyn. And I was helping folks access public benefits. So access food stamps, TANF assistance. And, you know, they would run into the same problems when they would go to HRA, that's their DSS, over and over and over again.
Mm.
And, you know, and eventually you're really proud of yourself because you helped this person, you know, get benefits or you helped this person, you know, improve their life in some way. Mm. But then after you've done that, a few times, you're kind of like, why am I keep having to do this? Well, yeah. There's a problem here. Mm-hmm. And so then you really start to get into, you know, why does that problem exist and what can we do about it?
Mm. So, I mean, what, from your assessment, what did you see is the problem? Did the institution just not have the proper procedures in order to make those services accessible? Or, I mean, what did you see as a problem?
I mean, ultimately, it's about priorities, right? It's mm-hmm. about how, you know, we are choosing to invest our dollars as communities, you know, or as our state, our country. How are we, you know, what's important to us? And that, you know, that trickles down to, you know, when you're underfunding public benefits, the folks who, you know, are in charge of administering that, they're underfunded as well. They're underpaid. Mm-hmm. You know, like the whole system kind of really is designed top down. And I think that's what's neat about, you know, working in community is that, you know, there's this effort to take power and, you know, go bottom up.
Mm. Do you find that there are many people on an institutional level who are open to that process in terms of building things from the foundation as opposed from the opposite way, the top-down approach?
Sure. Yeah. I think there are 100% there are people who are interested in that. Mm-hmm. You know, but that's where, you know, identifying them and helping them understand that they have support to do that work, because they're, you know, they're hearing it from all other sides. You know, you talk about, there's this, particularly when we're talking about people in poverty, there's, you know, there's this deserving versus undeserving poor. You know, so who's mm-hmm. deserving? Well, you know, veterans, they're deserving. Mm-hmm. Who's not deserving? Well, the low-income, you know, woman on welfare who, you know, by somebody's estimation had too many kids, you mm-hmm. know. So yeah. Who's deserving? Everybody's deserving, but mm-hmm. we don't talk about it that way.
Wow. Why do you think that? It's not talked about that way. We're going to keep going
deeper.
Right,
we're good. That's exactly what we're doing. We're going deeper and deeper. You know, I mean, I think, you know, we could talk all day about the institutions and, you mm-hmm. know, the folks who it's in their interest to keep people down, mm-hmm. For mm-hmm. sure.
Yeah. And I mean, so being in New York City, in Brooklyn, and doing this type of work, did this kind of set a path or a trajectory for you to eventually establish and found the Homeless Alliance of Western New York?
Yeah. So, I mean, so doing that work, I mean, I was fortunate enough to, you know, work with some great public interest attorneys there. Mm. And that's really kind of where, you know, that little voice that I heard, you know, from my grandmother or, you know, or somebody saying, you should be a lawyer, you know, when I was talking back, that, you know, then that started to become real in my head, you know. And so I went to UB Law. And then I worked in Albany for a little bit as a legislative coordinator. Mm. We, you know, our work was around hunger, homelessness, and poverty. So it was, how are we, you know, working around the state budget? How are we increasing access to funds? You know, all these kinds of things. And then I wanted to get back to Western New York, where I'm originally from. Mm-hmm. And through my work in Albany, I'd made good contacts here in Western New York, and they said there's a need for this. And yeah. So came back here and had a fantastic board of directors for another organization that was already in place, and they said, this is what we want to do. And together we eventually founded the Homeless Alliance.
Oh, wow. And then while you were at UB as a student attorney,
that's when I worked for NLS for the first time. Yeah. So, I mean, really coming back to NLS as the executive director, you know, 25 years later is really a lot of coming home.
Yeah. Wow. So seeing it from this 25-year lens of lived experience, as opposed to being this young, bright-eyed student at at the University of Buffalo and, you know, doing this work, what's one of the major differences that you see now from when you were that student who was working in this organization at that time?
I think the, you know, the scope of the organization and how much it's grown is really incredible to me. I mean, with, you know, we have five offices, two in Buffalo, one in Niagara Falls, Lockport, and Batavia. And we represent five counties, Erie, Niagara, Genesee, Wyoming, and Orleans counties. We closed 7,000 cases last year, you know, serving over 14,000 people. And so, I mean, just the scope of it at this point is really incredible. But the basic work that we do remains the same. It's meeting people, you know, where they are, where they live, and helping them improve their lives.
Yeah, and you have to have a heart for this type of work too, you know? And I'm not sure if people can be taught to have that type of heart. I'm not sure. You know, what is your perspective on that? Can people go to school and learn how to do this work and it be just work that is, you know, from a cognitive or an intellectual perspective? Or is that something that people's hearts need to be centered in?
You know, it's interesting because I think you can come at it from a lot of different perspectives. Mm-hmm. Because yes, you can be somebody who has the heart for this and a compassion for others. Mm-hmm. But there's also a justice piece of this, you know, that we lean into as lawyers, you know, where this is fair and this is what the law says. Mm-hmm. And let's make sure that the law is followed. So, you know, at the end of the day, you know, we're still a law firm. You know, we're one of the larger law firms locally, actually. But, you know, at the end of the day, like there's the law and we need to make sure that people are following it.
Yeah. And, you know, like when we were speaking off of the record, you know, I talked about where I live at in Niagara Falls. Mm-hmm. I know for a fact that residents are completely unaware of all of the various different services and resources that are available to them. You know, just looking at this brochure, you help residents with housing around evictions and unsafe housing conditions, public benefits. Mm-hmm. I know that there's a lot of people that do not realize that they can have legal representation when it comes to dealing with the Department of Social Services.
Right.
You know, or if they have medical issues that are actually going on. What have been some of the more consistent concerns and issues that you've been seeing so far with a lot of people that come to neighborhood legal services?
Yeah, so, I mean, it really does run the gamut, like you said. So evictions and eviction prevention and defenses, that's our largest area. And we partner with other legal services agencies here in Western New York around a project called the Western New York Eviction Prevention Program. And, mm-hmm. you know, so we partner with those organizations and very thankful for their support. It's nice to see a community of legal service providers coming together around a common issue, and that, you know, that issue being, you know, eviction. You know, so that's certainly a biggest part of what we do. Mm-hmm. Our family law piece is a big piece of what we do. So this could be, you know, helping a survivor of family violence. This could be, you know, helping somebody, you know, leave an abuser, you know, the creation of a plan for leaving, you know, working with our incredible partners around the community on that. You know, we have our public benefits piece, like you mentioned, which is, you know, really incredible. And that's kind of that's where I cut my teeth, you know, when I was, you know, a volunteer lawyer with Neighborhood Legal Services a long time ago. Mm-hmm. You know, this idea that, you know, so often folks, you know, may not realize that they are, you know, being improperly denied. How are we assisting them to make sure that they know their rights, that they are represented, so they can get what they need to get back on their feet?
Mm-hmm. So what have been some of the biggest challenges that you've seen thus far?
Let me narrow that down. There's many challenges everywhere. So, like, what particular area?
Just in regards to, you mentioned that your organization closed about 7,000 cases, and would you say most of those were around like housing?
A lot of them are. Yeah, I mean, and you know, not everybody who's evicted is going to become homeless, but mm-hmm. you know, certainly a lot of them might. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's certainly a passion area of mine that, you know, I want to make sure that we're continuing to do that kind of work. It's really very important.
Yeah, and I could imagine that you have to have funding to be able to do this type of work. Do you receive funding on a state level? Do you receive federal funding for the work that you do? And does that cause any kind of challenges in regards to services that you're able to provide?
So our eviction prevention piece comes from the state, and then we supplement that with other sources. We receive funding at the federal level from the Legal Services Corporation, which comes with a number of prohibitions and some strings and things like that. But it's core funding that we need to survive. But so a lot of our funding does come from on the government side of things, which in this environment can be really challenging. It's one of the reasons why, as an organization, you know, we want so very badly to work hard to increase our donor base, help get the word out about not just the services we provide to those who might use them, but to the community at large, so that they understand the impact that we have, the economic impact that we have, in the community. And then also, we want to do a better job of partnering with private attorneys and getting their involvement in the work that we do. Because we feel like, you know, we have so many attorneys and we're all doing great work, but they're stretched thin. And there is a need out there that that exists that we just aren't able to meet because we just don't have enough. So maybe if we can increase the number of private attorneys who are involved with us on a pro bono basis and then increase our donor base, maybe we can meet the need better in the community. That doesn't mean that we're looking to, you know, empire build or, you know, expand greatly, but there's a need that needs to be met, and we want to meet that need.
So in terms of private attorneys being able to be a part of this pro bono, are these attorneys just within New York State?
Yes.
Or is it just also just in Western New York?
I mean, certainly in the, you know, in the five counties that we serve, I mean, that's where we'd be looking to get most of our attorney involvement work. So, you know, if you're an attorney in Erie, Niagara, Genesee, Orleans, or Wyoming counties and are interested in working with us, we want to work with you.
Okay. So just generally speaking, how would a person be able to access services? Because, you know, obviously they're free, and then sometimes people really don't believe that.
Yeah.
You know? So how do they access the services?
So there's a couple different ways. People can access our service through our website, which is NLS.org, NLS, so Neighborhood Legal Services, NLS.org. And then they can call our phone number, 716-847-0650. So 716-847-0650.
And then what's the process? What should they expect once they call this number or they reach out?
That's such a great question. And we continue to refine our intake process. But at the very least, what happens is there's an intake assessment which takes place. And if we can serve you, then hopefully we can serve you. And if we can't, we try to make a referral out to maybe another agency or another agency that might better be able to meet your needs. But if we can help you, then we, you know, go a step further and try to assign you to one of our units to try to work with you with your problems. You know, one of the great things about NLS is that usually when folks are coming forward and presenting an issue, it's never just one issue, if somebody's coming with an eviction, but they might also have a problem accessing, you know, a housing benefit, or maybe they have a health issue or something like that, sometimes we can help navigate that piece. Or maybe they have a housing issue because they're fleeing domestic violence. You know, because we have these great units, you know, that specialize in these different areas, we try to make sure that, you know, each of those units are not just siloed, but are, you know, working together to meet the needs of our clients.
You had mentioned earlier that, and this is, of course, off of record, but you had mentioned that you started off as an activist and then moved into a space of more advocacy. What is the difference from activism to advocacy?
Yeah, so my career has been one that, you know, kind of began on the activist side, and then it became much more of an advocate, and then I became a bureaucrat, and now I'm kind of in a position that blends all of that. You know, first of all, I mean, it's, you know, every time you make one of those jumps, it's an, you know, you're going through an identity crisis because you view yourself, I'm like, I'm this activist. And then you're like, well, why am I not out there in the streets anymore? Why am I, you know, walking the halls of, you know, in Albany trying to, you know, get something done? And then I was a bureaucrat. And why am I, you know, now I'm the person that I used to rail against. And then, you know, and then in this position, I'm kind of blending that all together. But in each of those steps, I wouldn't call it a progression because no role is better than the other. But, you know, you're making you view yourself in different ways.
Yeah.
That didn't get to where you wanted to go, was it?
No, what I was thinking is how you being the executive director in this position, because you have that lived experience, oftentimes you have people who are in positions and they have not done any kind of active work before. or they've never really advocated or done any of that. You have that background and that experience, you know, and I think that is a valuable asset that a lot of times people in these type of positions don't even have.
Sometimes, and then I think sometimes, you know, I think my experience is less uncommon than one might think. I often feel a great affinity with folks who are leading, you know, some of the other not-for-profit agencies in the community because, you know, they have had that journey. Because I think ultimately it is really, really helpful to an organization to have all those different experiences on hand.
Have you written a book yet? Not yet? I know I'm not the first person that suggested that.
You might be, you know.
Really?
I don't get asked the questions that you're asking me very often.
So. Wow, because I'm genuinely interested, though, you know, and I know, like I said, the importance of this organization. There's many people because, like I mentioned, I do community engagement in Niagara Falls, and oftentimes residents come to me seeking different services or representation in various different aspects. And that's not my area of expertise. So I know there is a need.
Yeah. Yeah. But you're doing that first piece, though, about listening, you know, and when you listen and can identify the problems, that's when you know how to act. So, you know, one of the number of years ago, there was this, I can't remember if it was a book or I think it was a book, and it was called Everything I Ever Needed to Know I Learned in Kindergarten. And it was basically like, you know, hold hands, be kind, you know, all these, you know, things that everybody should know. And I think often everything I ever needed to know, I learned as a community organizer, you know, this whole idea that we have to listen first before we act. That we need to come together as a community to achieve community goals. Community problems require community solutions. And, you know, I think that's the common thread throughout my career is listening, then act, and then acting, you know, and making sure that you have buy-in. Like that's one of the key pieces that I think people often miss is that there's this idea that we just need to charge ahead all the time. And, you know, but it's, you know, if you want to get someplace fast, go it alone. If you want to get someplace, you know, and make lasting change, then you go together.
Okay. So in Niagara Falls, I've been familiar with legal aid, and I'm not sure how long they've been around, but in terms of neighborhood legal services, how long has this organization been in existence? And, you know, in terms of providing these resources to the community?
I'm really glad you asked that because we've been around for 50 years. And
what?
This is our 50th anniversary year.
50 years?
50 years.
What?
Yeah. And as a matter of fact, we're going to be having a gala on July 10th to celebrate our 50 years where we're going to be, you know, honoring some of our folks, including some of our founders and long-standing partners. And we're really excited about it.
Oh, wow. Do you have a location where the gala is going to be?
Yes, it's going to be at the Powerhouse, which is really kind of a cool and exciting space.
Oh, wow.
I love reclaimed spaces like that.
Wow. So in terms of looking forward 2026, what are some of the goals that you have leading this organization into this year?
Yeah. So like any big organization, you know, we have, you know, there's always some areas that you want to try to shore up, you know. So I think, you know, we had a tremendous period of growth with our previous executive director, Lauren Breen, where she really took the organization and doubled it in size and doubled our services, did an incredible job. And anytime you have an expansion like that, you always kind of need to take a little bit of a pause and just kind of see where you are, reassess, make sure all your funding is stable, make sure your organization is stable. And so that's kind of the period that I'm in right now. You know, as a new executive director, I'm still learning the organization, still, you know, trying to figure out where we move forward. But I think that a couple things are clear. You know, we need to get ourselves out there into the community a little bit more, make our services known, make our name known so that folks, whether you're a private attorney and, you know, want to help out in a pro bono way, or you're somebody who needs our services, or if you are a, you know, somebody who would like to support our work, we want you to know about us. So that's a big piece of what it is that we want to accomplish. You know, and then I think, you know, we're neighborhood legal services, And, you know, we got our name originally because we had these, we were in the neighborhood, mm-hmm. you know, and, you know, we've still have these, we have these five offices now. And, you know, it's still a matter of if you are, you know, if you are in a rural farmhouse in Wyoming County, or you're in an apartment in Buffalo, we want you to be able to access our services, mm-hmm. and we want you to know that we're there for you. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what are we doing to make sure that we're reaching all of those spaces? And, you know, that's why we opened up our space at 47 Court Street, which is where folks can walk in and receive services. And we also have our Justice Bus, which travels into rural communities and actually all communities, you know, bringing, you know, legal education to folks. You know, I think, you know, meeting people where they are and making justice and access to justice feel accessible to them is really, really important. You know, we need to, you know, establishing and defending your rights, you know, should not be intimidating. It's yours. These are your rights. Mm. Like, so how do we make that feel more comfortable for folks? And, you know, part of that is, you know, if we can bring our advocates to people where they are, you know, and then we grow that comfort.
Wow. Could you talk a little bit more about the Justice Bus? That sounds like a cool concept. I've never heard of that before.
Yeah. So, I mean, we've got a great, team of folks who staff the Justice Bus, and they will go to events, and sometimes they, you know, are tabling and letting folks know about our, you know, about our services. Sometimes they are able to do an intake out right there out in the community, where they're able to then take that intake back to some of our other attorneys in our units, who are then able to work with them. Sometimes they're out there providing a training. Maybe it's you know, tenants' rights, or, you know, any number of other kinds of legal training. So they're actually out there bringing the work of NLS to, you know, that rural community, or to that community center, you know, in Niagara Falls, or mm-hmm. wherever it might be, making sure that, you know, that they're able to access services where they are.
Yeah, I think that is definitely a powerful asset to have, especially at local schools, you know, for field trips where students can just, you know, it can be right on site. They can go right outside of the school with the teacher and learn a little bit more about the work that you do.
For sure. For sure. Yeah, no, it's exciting stuff. I think it's definitely an area that we want to lean into. Mm-hmm. You know, this idea that, you know, we're neighborhood legal services. We should be in the neighborhoods.
That was Saladin Law with Executive Director, Neighborhood Legal Services. Coming up next, Naila Ansari-Cotillo speaks with Talia Johnson-Huff of MWBE Constructors. This is What's Next from Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR.
Calling all storytellers in kindergarten through third grade. The Buffalo Toronto Public Media PBS Kids Writers Contest is back. Here are the details for parents, caregivers, and educators. Kid writers from Western New York and Southern Ontario can send us their stories until March 31st for a chance to win prizes and be featured in a celebration live streamed from our studios. Don't wait. Visit btpm.org/writerscontest to submit your entry today.
Buffalo Toronto Public Media NPR brings you trusted, local journalism every day. Our reporters are in your communities covering the stories that shape Western New York and Southern Ontario. The issues, people, and decisions that matter. Add national perspective from the BBC and Here and Now, and you're connected to the larger world without losing sight of home. Stay informed with reporting that you can trust on BTPM NPR.
Corey here with the Compact Civics Expansion Pack.
America is such a big, wide, awesome place, and to be able to see things that are representative of so many different places, it can be so important when brought to your tiny town.
Everybody is so kind and loving. I'm here in Buffalo just because of State Buffalo.
From urban farms to rural fairs, we'll celebrate spaces that bring us together and create community.
Watch on the Buffalo Toronto Public Media YouTube channel. From the fringes of the mainstream to the local music you love. Listen to Buffalo Toronto Public Media at the Bridge Monday through Thursday, 8 p.m. to midnight on BTPM NPR at 88.7 or from your smart speaker.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues of our communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the BTPM Listen app, and we will work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern that we should be addressing? Email us using whatsnext@btpm.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that are needed. This is Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR.
Welcome to What's Next. I'm Naila Ansari Cotillo, where we focus on the ideas, people, and movements shaping what comes after our conversation. Today, we're talking about access to Black business, the Sankofa Conference, and not just the visibility or intention, but what it actually takes to build sustainable, profitable businesses inside those systems that you will definitely be talking about at the Sankofa Conference. February 28th at Buffalo Academy for Visual and Performing Arts, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m.
Yes.
And I'm joined by Talia Johnson Huff, founder of the MWBE Constructors Inc. and the creator of Black Business Curriculum. Talia works at the intersection of construction, entrepreneurship, and equity, helping businesses move from surviving to scaling, which is a lot.
It's a lot. Like, that was a mouthful. You made me sound so good.
I know. Trying to piece it all together, but your coaching and the branding and the work that you're doing is incredible. And I know we talked before we even got on air, is, you know, the space that you're in and construction and contracting is no joke, especially as a woman and as a Black woman specifically.
Listen.
So we're going to dive into
I'm excited.
into all of the things. So, you know, this idea of Black business access is important for the Sankofa Conference that's going to be on February 28th. Can you talk about what does that look like? How do you define Black business access?
You know, I've been a Black business owner since the age of 12. And, you know, being in it and not really knowing that you're in it, because a lot of us have been doing business, you know, since we were younger. And this Black business access for me, being in it for so many years, truly means that this is bringing together all that we've learned, you know, over time, what we've learned from our grandparents, from our aunts, from our uncles, from those we saw in businesses, right? From the corner stores, you know, the penny candy stores, everybody in our neighborhoods, bringing that together and then moving forward in it, right? And then and accessing what's available to us, like government contracting and, you know, being able to go after smaller contracts, connecting with our city, our county, our state. So really, it's like becoming a part of the ecosystem that a lot of businesses that are not Black and brown have had access to for many years before we even were able to walk into that space.
Mm-hmm. What does access really mean beyond the visibility and the representation, right? Because sometimes it could just be a very performative thing, right?
Hello.
Like that was, and we saw a lot of that when, we, you know, it was a big trend of like DEI, like, oh, let's go get a Black business without actually doing the work of what it means to really give access and equity. So can you speak a little bit to that?
Yes. You know, it's funny because this is still happening today, you know, and I'm so glad you brought that up because this is so... My journey and really what I like to talk about is being a minority woman-owned business that's state certified to do business with the government, meaning that they're set aside contracts for us, right? So there's 30% of these contracts that have state funding, sometimes county funding, federal funding used to be, had a percentage on it that they needed to work with minority and women-owned businesses. And that has been going on. I know some businesses who have been certified since 1986. Right. So this has been going on for a very long time. It has not hit our community until maybe about 20 years ago. So we're behind 20 years. Right. And so when we say access, it's like, hey, we made it available to you all. So walk into that door. But how have you made it available? Right. Like, how do we find out about it? When does it hit our neighborhoods? You know, when does it hit our cities? When does our government tell us about it? And so there has been a lack of doing that. But now we're at the end of, I'll tell you, this MWBE program that New York State has going on only goes right now. It's safe until 2028.
Oh, wow. So it's coming up.
So it's coming up to where they're going to, you know, like take a look at it and see, hey, did this program do what it needed to do? And I will tell you real numbers. I'm a numbers person. The numbers right now look like, these are real numbers, y'all. Look like, okay, out of that 30%, they are exceeding their goals, right? They are exceeding their goals with minority and women-owned businesses. But when you talk about access, let's talk about what the minorities number looks like versus the women-owned number looks like. It looks like 28% women-owned business and 2% minority-owned business. Mm-hmm. That's where there's a lack of access. And now, you know, I have been hitting the pavement so hard trying to get this in front of business owners who sell everything, provide all different types of services because the government buys everything.
Right. And it's interesting because that also happened with affirmative action. So it's like the whole notion that it was like, oh, this is only going to serve, you know, Black folks. It's actually, it didn't do what it says it was going to do.
No.
Which brings me to my question, which you tapped a little bit upon on the certifications mm-hmm. and the paperwork that goes yes. into a lot of this work, particularly in sustaining businesses, that a lot of our folks really don't know much about. So can you talk about the importance of
the
that?
Paperwork?
And, yeah.
Yeah. You know what? Access and education go hand in hand. And a lot of our businesses aren't ready. And that's what's happening. So, you know, you're talking about paperwork and I'm talking about things such as knowing our profit and loss statement, knowing what it is. You know, are we actually making money? Knowing how to price our services and our products, because we don't know how to do that. We say, hey, here's this bottle of water and I'm going to sell it to you for $3. But what was the cost of that water? What did it cost you? We don't even know what our profit margins are, if we're breaking even, if we can even, you know, make enough to stay open this month. Mm-hmm. That's just one aspect of it. The other aspect of it is we're not filing our taxes. You know, we don't know an accountant. And if we do, who are they? Are they turning things over in a timely manner? So it's things of that nature that we are not focusing on. And then our credit. Mm-hmm. Our credit, and as you know, and as we all know, it has been holding us back for years. Credit is something that has been holding us back for years. And we're in this, I would say, trend of, oh, well, I can just open up a business and use my business credit. Well, as you know, most things have personal guarantees.
Right, right.
So we still need your personal credit. So the education piece about knowing what your business actually needs to qualify before you even touch a certification application, those are just some of the things that you'll need to be able to gain access to now these set-aside contracts and certifications and things of that sort, is knowing your basic business information.
And the Sankofa conference is really kind of tackling all of those things. Because,
that's so awesome.
You know, it's interesting because you talk about like evaluations of companies and how do you do that? Like that, it is a numbers game that a lot of us don't know. Or, you know, in our communities, people have been doing businesses in their, you know, in their houses
yes.
for a long time and not knowing that you can make it viable or that you can scale
Absolutely.
It.
Absolutely.
Can you talk about the importance of having a conference like this to be able to spread that information out?
You know, I love my community. And one of the things that I love is that, you know, there are, you know, people like Emmanuel and mm-hmm. Aria who, you know, say, hey, listen, I have gone all over the world. I've learned this and I'm going to bring it back to my backyard, my neighborhood. This conference is connecting that. This conference is saying, hey, let's build legacy, right? Let's build Black wealth. Let's bring all of these key players to the table, which is like unheard of. Get them in a room. And let them teach, let them train, let them educate, let them empower it so that we can elevate to the next level. I can't even explain how important this is to me because it makes me emotional. Mm-hmm. I just wish that it came sooner.
Right.
You know, and all we can say is like thankful that we're able to be a part of it because now we know what we know. So now we know better, we can do better. And I think this conference is going to be the kickoff of something amazing for years to come.
In terms of sustainability, which is, you know, an issue in a lot of terms of Black owned businesses, there's a lot out there on social media. Everybody has a class. Everybody has, you know, all these different podcasts and things like, how can you tell the difference between real information and, you know, people getting scammed about, you know, just growing their business, you know, because everyone's now it's on social media.
Absolutely.
Grow your business. Do this for Black owned
yes.
businesses. And it can get very confusing. I can go online sometimes and be like, okay, wait, is this
overwhelming?
Is this good or is this
very overwhelming?
So how do you find what's real?
You know what I say? First of all, I'm a Bible girl, right? I come from a Christian family, Christian background. You will know them by their fruit. And that's the truth. And so for me, it's like, what have you done? What can I tap into? What can I find out about what you've produced? Mm-hmm. Because it's one thing to say like, hey, there's an ad, there's a sponsor ad on TikTok or Instagram or LinkedIn. But what have you done to help businesses? Because before you start charging, what have you done for free? What have you brought to your community? How much access have you allowed to happen through your hands, through the work of your hands, the work of your ecosystem? So, you know, I'm the same way. I'm scrolling. Sometimes I see things. I mean, someone wanted to, you know, have me buy into ClickFunnels. Mm-hmm. It was like $10,000 a month before I even finished my book. And I'm like, well, wait, like, what have you done? I don't need another AI generated thing. And I'm not saying anything is wrong with AI. Obviously, mm-hmm. it's our future. But we still need the touch and the feel, and we need to understand like about our businesses. So if I can't see you and if you don't understand where I'm coming from, how can you teach me? How can you right. fully teach or train me? So I always say like, know them by their fruit. Do your research, check and see what they've done, how much they've helped, how much access have they given before putting your money, because that's a money, that's an investment that you're making. So
it's an investment that you're making. And it, you know, with everything that's happening to your point with AI, you also have to be smart enough to be able to put the inputs in.
Oh my gosh.
As well. So you can't just listen to everything. And you know, sometimes I think we fall victim into a lot of that, of like that quick money.
Yes.
Like own a business, start a business and just do that. But there's a lot of work that goes into being a business owner, right? Like
striking a chord, right? Playing the guitar.
Because the notion is right now is like everybody can own a business, but everybody may not necessarily be meant to own a business.
That's it.
Right. You have to, it is a 24-hour job.
It is a 24-hour job. And, you know, when I broke down how much I was making in my business versus getting a regular job, at one point it was $8 an hour.
Mm-hmm.
Because I had to really take a look at my numbers. It's your numbers. What are you producing? It's great to have a business, but I will say this, and it's probably not going to be popular, so walk me out after this. It's one thing to have your name in lights, but do you have money in the bank? Because your name in lights and popularity does not pay the bills, and you're not powering your ecosystem. You're not powering your community by just being popular. Because are you hiring people? Are they able to get jobs through you? Are they able to get access? Are they find out information from you? What are you actually bringing to the table? And is your business actually making money? And honestly, about 80% of businesses have no clue, because they have someone in the office who they may hire an office manager. There's people who have staffed businesses that have multiple employees and do not know what their bottom line is. They're trusting Miss Sally in the office, their mm-hmm. office managers. And I'm hearing these businesses who have been in business for 40 plus years, people are stealing thousands upon thousands of dollars from them just because people don't know their businesses. They can't tell their profit and loss and, you know, if they're in the black. That's why I wrote Black in Business. It's like, I'm black, obviously, and I'm in business, but it's a double entendre, because being in the black actually making money. So, you know, we have to make sure that before we open a business, we understand what it takes and we're ready to be able to take that on. And then we have something put up to be able to, you know, rely on when that rainy day comes.
And that's such a great point, because we rely so much on other people. You really have to know all of your,
absolutely,
your business. And it's funny because, you know, I recently just did a workshop and we were talking about, you know, folks not really understanding tech in a certain way, but you know, you give all your social media or
yes.
your email handle, and then someone leaves, they take it with them, and then you lost all of that capital in that kind of way. So it's like, it's important to understand the business in totality, not just kind of being the face of it or the brand of it.
That's so important.
So I want to go to a little bit of lived experience. I think this is also important in businesses. And I know it'll definitely be tapped upon at the conference. But you grew up at your father's contracting business.
I did.
And so, you know, 12 years old, you're already there in the midst of it, and you're working with agencies and small businesses now. Where have you personally seen the breakdown in Black businesses?
It used to be that when we look at a lot of other cultures, we see that they are creating legacy businesses from very young. I mean, we are in the corner stores and we're seeing that little kids are checking you out, cashing you out in the corner stores, right? That stopped in our community a very long time ago, right? It's like, oh, I want to do something else. I'd rather go work here. I want to go get my, and there's nothing wrong with getting your degree, but legacy businesses have left, where when you're in a legacy business, nine times out of 10, you don't have to worry about Miss Kathy running away with $30,000 because there's a son, there's a daughter, there's a niece, there's a nephew who has more, I would say, equity in the business and who feels more passionate about it because their aunt, uncle, mom, father ran it, right? So that's what I feel like is one of the breakdowns. Another thing that is one of the breakdowns is being busy. Mm-hmm. A lot of times we start businesses because we're good at something, right? I'm good at, I'm a cosmetologist and master barber by trade. That was my first trade, right? I'm
y'all great at see that. Talia, y'all could tell that she is.
Don't judge me. Extra. But you know, that was my first trade. I'm great at doing that. I'm great at cutting hair, having convos, can make, I made six figures behind a chair a couple years ago, right? Easy. But the problem was I was stressed out. I couldn't do that. My payroll, know my books, know my numbers, be able to continue marketing, building my business and creating a platform for other people and a voice. I constantly wanted to build something new and I was burnt out. And burnout happens so easily when we do not have a plan in place and that we're working in our business instead of on our business. So are you an entrepreneur or are you just taking on a very long hour, long body driven, beaten down, long trotting? I don't know. I'm making up right. Are you taking that on? Right. So being smart about it and creating a strategic plan before you walk into it and learning that it's okay to be outside of your business and put somebody else in there and then just watch over it.
It's so interesting you said that because my next question is actually going to be about scaling. So a lot of people are at, you know, if they talk about starting businesses and they go online, it's like, oh yeah, I can start this thing, which is, you know, startup world is a whole different conversation that looks very different from, you know, in our communities that we understand startup. But what's equally as difficult or maybe more difficult is actually scaling the business.
Absolutely.
And that's where we tend to stop in our communities, is that it doesn't extend past where we kind of been for a long time.
Absolutely. I agree. And that is, scaling for me has been difficult because I am my brand, right? I am my business. People know me. They want me. But a lot of times they can't have me because I can't be here, there, and everywhere. So what does that look like to teach and train and bring someone along? So it's also important to have mentees that you're working with early. Go into the schools and, you know, pick a little Black girl who looks like you and introduce her to construction and be okay with passing that torch so that you can work on your business and leave a legacy behind if you don't have children or someone else who wants to walk into that space. So it is important to understand that you don't have to work yourself to the bone. The most successful business owners just oversee things.
Yeah.
And that is what I believe is the difference between entrepreneurship and business ownership, is that we're very passionate as entrepreneurs, but as business ownership, it means I'm over this and I need to get to the dollars and the cents.
Mm-hmm.
So,
which is, you know, it's always interesting because there's always been a kind of a clash for in the Black community when folks choose to sell their businesses.
Come on.
And it kind of looks like you're like a sellout, which is, so I wanted to actually get to this question. It's, I mean, we could go so deep into this, right? Like, but
I love it.
But go to the Sankofa conference, they will go deep into to these topics. But the technicality versus like the culture. Mm-hmm. And I've seen that, I remember with like Honey Pot and there's, you know, a couple other businesses that they were, you know, when they were like selling their businesses, Black folks were like culturally like, why are you selling your business to the white man? You know?
Yes.
But they don't understand that the role of entrepreneurship is that you keep getting businesses and you sell them so that you can keep generating more wealth and helping your community out.
That's
and
it.
So forth and so on, which a lot of other communities do. So can you talk about the you know, the technicality of business versus the cultural issues we might have?
You know what? You have to understand in business, you have to have a why. Right? What is your why? When you start that business, what is the why? And a lot of times when I'm working with business owners and I'm coaching, I'm asking them, what is their why? And honestly, I'm telling them, like, listen, stop opening up LLCs. Go back to work, LLC. Because you wanted to create this candle business because you like making candles. Maybe the best thing is for you to go into the schools and teach children how to make candles as a way of coping, as a coping mechanism, right? Because you were stressed out. So now you can go help someone teach and train. Nonprofit. Some people only have nonprofit organizations and they're trying to run them as a business. What is your why? We lose our passion, we lose our zeal because we get burnout, we forget our why. And we allow other people to tell us what we need to do. Like, listen, if Honey Pot opened that business to scale it big enough to be able to sell it, you don't know what they're onto. What's the next thing that they're onto? And they're employing communities. Their idea now will live, continuously live on, and they're able to It's still a legacy. And you know, and so we have a lot of opinions about what other people are doing with their brands, with their businesses. What are you doing with yours? That is the focus for 2026. And my mind is, put your blinders on. Stay focused on you. Honeypot is good.
Right, right.
Okay, with a D and a T at the end. Right, right. Okay, don't worry about that. They're going to be good. But what are you building and why?
And I think that the what's your why is always good. It's, that's a great example because some people, everything is not meant to be a business. Having 15 million LLCs is not helpful because it doesn't allow you to scale because it's not manageable.
It's not.
In that way, right? To have a like constant amount of startups.
And all that money that you just spent and that you exhausted that you do not have and then you're saying, I'm looking for a loan from someone, but you started 90,000 LLCs at $210 a pop.
Right.
But that's none of my business.
Right. We can't. But in our community, that's what it's been, though. Like, that's how we've understood the, you know, business and entrepreneurship is just to keep, you know, doing things over and over and over again and not necessarily scaling them to the point where you can sell them or make them a generational legacy that you keep pushing forward.
Yes.
You know, I do want to talk about this word, the equity language.
Yes.
You know, what is the difference between the equity in the statement versus the equity in action?
Oh, geez. I was on Channel 7. Shout out to Ed Drench. That's my homeboy. I was on Channel 7. I was talking to Ed and we were having this conversation about what is equity. And I'm like, you know, I'm like, it's one thing to be able to say, oh, you can shop at the same grocery stores as, you know, these different, I'm horrible with this. I'm not really good at like backgrounds and stuff like this. Right. So anyway, as the others. It's another thing to say I have access to the same things that they have access to, whether that's buying a home or, you know, access to learning how to build my credit, right? Because I truly believe that we have all of the pieces within our ecosystem to be able to continue in equity and walk in equity, but we also gatekeep a lot, right? So if you have information that I need, you would rather sell it to me than share it with me over dinner, right? Mm-hmm. Or if you have access to, you know, something that could potentially catapult my business, you would rather keep it unless I make you a partner. And so I truly believe that's the breakdown. And when you talk about equity and when you talk about making, in my mind, equity is leveling the playing fields and making sure that we're all on the same level playing field. That can never happen if we're also competing with each other because we're all supposed to be on the same team over here. And so how can we get over there if everybody is like trying to run and trample? Like, anyway, it becomes what I call a domino effect to where we're all knocked down.
Right.
And that's not the name of the game. The name of the game is to, if you have, you know, this amazing business, if you're a honeypot and you have this amazing business idea and I have $1,000 and I don't know what to do with it, instead of buying these, you know, Jordans or whatever, I can say, hey, I want to invest in your business. And maybe I want to, you know, can I get one percent of your business, you know? If we do more of that, I truly believe that's how we level the playing field. And that's how we get to a point where the strongest businesses need to come forward, because that's what happens in other communities. Mm-hmm. They invest in those strong businesses, and those that are not strong, sometimes they sit on the back burner and they grow little by little until they're ready to now get in the game. So anyway.
Yeah. And I always say everybody's not broke either.
Everyone. Okay.
You know, you'd be surprised when people, you know, the money that they have, that people make assumptions based off what they look like or, you know, that they can't afford certain things. But people, when they know it's a good business plan, it's a good business idea, people want to be able to have an investment.
Absolutely.
That they can get back and you know, and get more back from what they put in. So final question for you as we close out and, you know, get ready for the Sankofa conference. I'm super excited.
I'm so excited.
Be there.
I'm so pumped.
The theme of the conference is Know Thyself, a call to the diaspora. What does that mean to you?
It's knowing what you bring to the table, you know, knowing that you're a big part of this change, right? Where we're going back to the beginning. We're going back to our trades, you know, the work of our hands, the legacy businesses, being able to reach back and grab others. And so for me, it truly means like, you know what? Back to your why. Go back to what you're good at. What are your skill sets? And truly, you know, do a vision board of where you are. I've been doing a vision board leading up to the Sankofa conference. And so I'm sharing that with other people because it's a reminder of who I am and what I come from. you know, and who's gone before me in my bloodline? What did they do? What did they drop that I can pick up, that I can grow on, that I can build on, like my dad's business, right? And that's what actually led me back to construction. So the Sankofa conference and knowing thyself and a call to the diaspora just means going back to those things that you dropped, scaling them, building them, and connecting to an ecosystem that is building them, like, you know, those who are connected to this conference.
Absolutely. Well, I'm looking at Talia, so that's called Fly Talia.
Thank you.
Make sure that you all come out February 28th at the Buffalo Academy for Visual and Performing Arts, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. for this amazing Sankofa conference. Thank you so much, Talia,
for being here.
For grounding this conversation with us. You know, it reminds us that that access isn't accidental, that we have to be purposeful in it.
I'm snapping on it.
And it's designed. So what's next depends on whether we're willing to redesign those systems and not just celebrate those outcomes. So thank you so much for being here. I'm Naila Ansari Cotillo, and this has been What's Next.
Support for the BTPM NPR What's Next podcast comes from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, partnering with the community to pursue racial and socioeconomic health equity. Learn more at hfwcny.org.